For a lot of us, there's at least a little wobble between the teen years and full adulthood. We've got a lot to learn about ourselves and the world, and it helps when there are people to fall back on when the going gets tough. We don't all have fallback people, and that makes the process of taking a place in the adult world that much harder. Disconnected young people are the focus of a new book by Ann Kim called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Ann Kim has a journalism degree, a law degree, and a lot of experience writing about economic opportunity, social policy, and higher education. She is certainly currently a contributing editor to Washington Monthly. Ann Kim, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey.
So we're talking about the people that Europeans tend to call NEETs for not in employment, education, or training. Who are the people and why are they so disconnected?
So in the United States, we're talking about 4.5 million young adults between the ages of 16 and 24 who are not in school and not working. Those figures are from a nonprofit called the Social Science Research Council's Measure of America Project. So that's 11.5% of all young adults in the United States. I took the liberty of looking up some of the numbers in your region, in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And you know, the state figures are about the same, 11.6. But if you're looking at county rates of disconnection, Southern Oregon actually has some of the higher rates. Klamath County, for example, is closer to 17%. If you're looking at Coos and Douglas counties, we're looking at 1 in 5 young adults who are disconnected from both school and from work. And so one of the challenges here is the regional disparities in who is connected and who is not.
Okay, so you're saying 20% in places like Curry and Douglas County.
Yes, yes. Wow. Yes, Portland, you know, as the one urban center, has the lowest rate of disconnection, about 10%, but that's still pretty high. We're talking about 1 in 10 mm-hmm. young adults in the Portland area who are not in school and not working, meaning they are completely cut off from mainstream economic opportunity in some way.
Well, let's talk about some of the contributing factors here. Emerging adults, it seems like, in your telling, have greater needs at this moment in history generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of middle-class parents, upper-middle-class parents, have come to realize that they need to invest in their college-age kids for a much longer period of time than they used to. You know, our economy has changed. You need a lot more education. You need the right kind of education. You need more expensive education. Used to be, you know, a couple generations ago, or even a generation back, you could graduate from high school, go down the street and get a job at a local factory or something like that. That's changed. And young adults who don't have parents who can help put them through college, or who are not even in a part of the country where they have access to educational opportunities or to jobs, it's become that much harder. The structural obstacles to succeeding have become much more significant. And just on, you know, this question of parental, extended parental support, the Federal Reserve did a study of young workers and found that 1 in 3 young adults ages 18 to 24 still gets help with their bills from mom and dad. It's become a fact of life these mm-hmm. days that if you're a young adult, you have to have your parents for much longer.
Right. So if you don't, as is the case with a lot of the people in this book, you really don't have any place. There's no fallback. There's no other place to go to. Now, the first example you give is a young woman you call Rochelle in New York City. What are her circumstances?
Right. So Rochelle is a young woman I met through a nonprofit called Cases out of New York City. And she is a young mom. She had a 3-year-old daughter at the time we met. She was struggling to stay employed. Now, she lived in the greater New York area. She'd been through the criminal justice system at a very young age, wrong place, wrong time, had made some youthful mistakes, was, you know, in a homeless shelter. There are all these systems around her that were intended to help her, meaning the welfare system. But she really felt like she was alone. She was living apart from her older sister and her mom. She had really no one to help her take care of her child. She'd actually just lost her benefits because her caseworker had made an appointment for her to come in during the work hours. And so she told me that she had, you know, been employed for like a 6-month period, the longest time that she'd been stable, and had just lost that kind of stability. Options for people like Rochelle are very, very limited in this circumstance. We don't have a lot of support for young adults who are in those kinds of circumstances, facing homelessness, unemployment, young parenthood, justice involved.
Well, you know, more than a century ago, and there was no concept of teenagers. You know, you were a child, and then you were an adult. Do we need more categories still? Is that part of the issue here?
It is. There's a sociologist named Jeffrey Arnett who wrote a really landmark book back in 2004, where he first identified this phenomenon that he called emerging adulthood. You know, and this, what we were talking about earlier about becoming a young adult is not just a sociological and cultural phenomenon, it's also a neurological one. There's brain science now that backs up the idea that between the ages of 16 and 25, young people's brains are undergoing a lot of development. These connections are happening between the frontal lobes of your brain, where all the judgment, reasoning, planning ahead, those kinds of things are taking place. And so those years between 16 and 24 have become so much more important, not just in terms of the kinds of connections you make economically, mentors you may have that connect you with internships, with first jobs, but how you are developing emotionally. So yes, we do need to recognize this phenomenon of young adulthood as an important new period in a person's life that needs more support, more investment, and more compassion for those who may make mistakes during this crucial period.
All right. We are talking about young people, 16 to 24, and the ones who don't have much in the way of connections and what happens in their lives and how much harder they have to work to get to someplace. The book by Ann Kim is called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. We'll come back to the exchange and talk more about the subject with Ann about the contents of her book. You can join the conversation by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. I can't get my brain unstuck from the fact that when you're talking about connections, you mean people. But when you talk about the neuroscience, we're also talking about brain connections, aren't we, Ann?
Yeah, we are. It's really very interesting what's been discovered just in the past couple decades or so. There used to be an assumption, I think, that brain development kind of ended in early childhood. You know, that's why so many middle-class parents have baby Einstein toys lying around the house. And then once you got to age five or so, it was too late to do anything after that. But that's simply not true. There is this, and I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm synthesizing what I discovered in my research, but there's quite a bit of research out there now that finds between ages of 16 and 24, there is a lot going on physiologically. So that means there's a second opportunity for learning, for development, to give kids a second chance who maybe did not have that shot in early childhood to get them set up for success as an adult.
Well, let's talk about the ways in which advantages tend to accrue to some members of the population and not to others. You write about your own story and about all the interns in Washington, D.C. They're not paid, many of them, but these are good launch pads for jobs, aren't they?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Internships are, there actually is research finding that those who intern are much more likely to find a full-time job after they graduate from college. You know, an internship, even if it is something as mundane as making coffee, you know, or Xeroxes or something like that, you are getting connected into a network of people who may help you for somewhere down the line. You may find a mentor who may know of another opportunity. You're also learning work skills like showing up on time, communicating with superiors. There's so many soft skills as well as hard skills can be picked up in an internship, but who can afford to take an unpaid internship? It's young people who have parents who can pay the rent in Washington, D.C. for 3 months, and that's not a small task, you know, or who can afford to reach out to their own connections to line something up for their kids. This, I think there's still a myth that if you just work hard enough that you're going to succeed, but I think the reality in today's economy is that these kinds of connections are so much more important than they used to be. Who you know, who you are, has become so much more critical to a young person's odds of success, and we need to figure out a way to equalize those kinds of opportunities So the young folks who are growing up with parents who don't have those kinds of resources and those kinds of connections can still get ahead.
So if you start with some privilege, other perks seem to accrue along the way.
It is self-perpetuating. That's absolutely the case. We see that already, with higher education. The people who are most likely to go and get college degrees are people whose parents have college degrees. No matter how much we like to think of colleges as, engines of opportunity and mobility, what they've become are reserves of privilege and a way for those who have privilege to perpetuate it for themselves. It's an unfortunate fact of life, I think, and the divergence that we're seeing in the fortunes of young adults is a really unappreciated driver of larger inequality that we're seeing. And it plays out at the regional level, too. There's so much geographic inequality that's happening right now, and it has to do with who has physical access to higher education and to jobs.
Yeah, and there are parts of the country you get to, and I do want to talk about that in just a bit. But if you're poor, you point out in the book, some benefits for young people vanish at their 18th birthday.
That's right. And that has to do with what we mentioned earlier about what you mentioned earlier, Jeffrey, about how when you're 18, you became an adult, and that was the end of it. A lot of our public programs were set up at a time when you could be 18 and you were on your own. And a generation ago, people were getting married earlier. They're having kids earlier. They could get jobs at an earlier age. But our public policies haven't kept up with how young adulthood has evolved over time. People aren't launching themselves independently until they're at least 24, and perhaps even later. One other factoid is that the average middle-class family can expect to invest about $50,000 in the young adult up to age 30. The amount of investment going into a young adult actually might be somewhat higher if you're in the upper end of the income spectrum than what they invested when their child was very young. That's how important that investment in young adulthood has become.
That boost after childhood, but before going out and being on your own. We're talking to Ann Kim here on the Jefferson Exchange about her book, Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. So give us another example that you ran across in the book. You take us to the Latin American Youth Center, LAYC Drop-In Center in Washington.
Right. Hugely underreported problem of youth homelessness. The Latin American Youth Center is one of only two drop-in centers for homeless youth in the greater Washington, D.C. area. There's research out there from Chapin Hall out of Chicago showing that about as many as 1 in 10 young adults will experience some period of housing instability, homelessness, over the course of a year. And we're seeing more research now about how even college students are facing housing instability and food insecurity as well. So what the drop-in center does is it provides homeless young people, and they see like 600 young adults over the course of a month, a place just to hang out during the day so they're safe. You can get a sandwich there. You can do your laundry there. It's really very shocking the extent to which these services are necessary in a place like downtown D.C. where you walk down the street and there's a Target, and there's your artisan coffee shop and your brewery and things like that. But in the very same neighborhood, you have homeless young people who are, desperately trying to make it, not knowing where the next meal is coming from.
Well, and this is where the word disconnection really took on its full meaning for me. I mean, because you think talk in terms of networking. I mean, forget it. These are people just trying to get a place to have a roof over their heads at night.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the ironies of the modern world that in some ways we are connected electronically, I guess, more than we ever have before. But you have so many young people who are literally disconnected, physically disconnected from the networks that really matter, to employers, to school, to parents, to mentors, to their communities. And it's one of the reasons why this problem, which I did not discover, there have been nonprofits that have been toiling for decades trying to bring this problem to light. But it's one of the reasons why this problem has not come to the fore, because these young people have literally dropped out of society. They're invisible, and it's up to the rest of us who are connected to forge those connections so that we don't have such a huge population of young adults who are our country's future. And it's going to get worse, I think, by the way, because of what's happening with the economy right now, young adults are going to bear the brunt. There may be many who are connected currently, but who are going to become disconnected because of the sudden shock that our economy is undergoing right now.
Yeah, with all the people locking up. Yeah, with all the people having to lock up for COVID-19 or just stay away from the economy, you get a lot of lack of activity. And so the lower wage jobs are the ones that are going to go away. And those are the ones that are held often by younger people. You mentioned nonprofits who are doing, and you're not kidding when you talk about invisible in this sense, because the nonprofits are keeping track of people who are who have no education, employment, or training, the NEETs, because neither the Census nor the Bureau of Labor Statistics keep stats on them.
That's correct. The United Kingdom, that keeps track of NEETs, they've been doing this since 1999. So every couple months or so, they will put out a report that says, you know, this is our percentage of NEETs. So the government knows, you know, here's our youth unemployment rate, here's what we need to do to direct more resources, because they do know that, you know, if your young people are unemployed, you're going to have older people who are unemployed somewhere down the line. If you look at our Census Bureau figures, you know, 18 to 64 is a single category, monolithic category, and we know that a worker who's between the ages of 18 to 24 is very different from someone in their prime working years. And those are different still from people who are nearing retirement age. We haven't focused, you know, they say that if you don't measure it, it doesn't matter. And we haven't focused our attention on just the data of understanding who it is that we need to help, how many people that we need to help, and then how best to target that help. So that's one reason why we are so vastly underinvested in young adults, because we don't keep track.
Ann Kim is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's written a book about people who don't have advantages growing up, and they get to their 18th birthday and they're thrust into the world of adulthood with no particular family or a safety net to fall back on. Her book is called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, talk about things you have witnessed in your own life or people you've noticed having these same sorts of struggles. 800-838-3760 gets you into the conversation by phone, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Not surprisingly, the research that is done finds that the people who are disconnected are often people either in rural areas or people of color or both. Let's go to the rural area first. Forest County, Pennsylvania, 73% in the age group 16 to 24 are not in school and not working. What's happening there?
Right. Now, Forest County, Pennsylvania is a county that is in the upper northwest of Pennsylvania, in the near the Allegheny Mountains, the Allegheny Forest, and so we're not talking about huge numbers of people necessarily, but you know, when you're talking about one young person, every young person matters. When I talked to the superintendent of schools there, a lot of the folks, the young people who are graduating from high school, do try to make it. They do try to go to college in the city, and they end up coming back. Culture shock, academic preparedness, there are a lot of reasons why people don't finish. And, you know, the fact is that a majority of people who go on to college don't finish with a four-year degree. But when you have to come back to a rural community where the lumber industry, which used to be the lifeblood of that community, no longer is, and machines have taken over a lot of that work, not a lot going on. I call these rural, I call these opportunity deserts in the book, and they can be rural areas or in urban areas. You are isolated from opportunities that are going to enable you to become self-sufficient. And in that part of Pennsylvania also, there's no physical university. You have to drive at least an hour to get to a community college.
So it sounds like if you're going to be successful, you're going to be getting out of Forest County.
Well, but can you? You know, I mean, what's happened in the nation, I think, is that, well, it's not that I think, it's a fact that urban areas are creating most of the jobs, but a lot of these jobs require higher education, and a lot of these places are also very expensive to live in. If you have neither of those things, the money to get yourself out of a place to be able to afford an apartment in a place like Washington, D.C., or Philadelphia, or Portland, and if you don't have the education to qualify for one of the tech jobs that are more likely to be created in those places, what do you do?
Well, you hope that something happens again, but that doesn't often happen. The economic mainstays, like the timber industry there and here for that matter, hasn't come back to where it previously was.
That's right. And I think what is happening with young adults is a kind of a canary in the coal mine. It's a symptom of these larger structural imbalances that are going on regionally across the country, the ways in which our economy is changing, but our public policies haven't adapted in a way that allows places like Forest County, Pennsylvania, or, you know, South Boston, Virginia, that's another area that I talk about in the book, they used to rely on tobacco, and they also had manufacturing. All of that went away in the early to mid-90s, and where they are in Virginia, there actually isn't a major university nearby. Longwood University is about 45 minutes away drive, not practical to get to class back and forth every day if you can even afford to go. So there's a lot of policy change that needs to happen to bring opportunity to places where it has dried up in the last 10, 20 years. And what's happening with young people is just a symptom of these bigger problems that we've got to tackle.
We've been talking mostly about rural up to this point, but let's talk urban again. Why Baltimore, for example, has a real Jekyll Hyde personality of opportunity, it seems.
It certainly does. It's one of those cities that on the surface looks like it's doing great. You've got great companies like Under Armour there. You've got, you know, an Amazon warehouse there. But if you go into the heart of Baltimore to a neighborhood called Sandtown, used to be prosperous 40 years ago, no longer. What you will see as you're driving down these streets, Lafayette Avenue, are block after block of boarded up townhomes. Maybe one or two cars on the street, but there are people who are living there. We've done a lot in terms of getting more students to graduate from high school, but the local high school in that part of town still is one of the dropout factories. Fewer than 60% of people in that high school graduate. You have very unreliable public transit. People I have spoken to for other research that I've done, it takes them 2.5 hours just to get across the city because the bus transit is unreliable and expensive and doesn't go where the jobs are. So, you have very stark inequalities within a city, not to mention that Baltimore has a long history of segregation as well. So you have these neighborhoods that are just islands of despair, really, within a country, within a city that's prospering in certain parts, but not sharing that prosperity, you know, across the board.
Now, there was something called the Youth Opportunity Initiative. What was that, and what happened with it over time?
Yes, that was a federal investment in trying to get young people connected. They had 10 youth opportunity centers across the city, billions of dollars being pumped in for a very short period of time. That money ran out. And one of the places where I went to in the book was the last remaining youth opportunity center that was operating on a shoestring budget, no federal dollars, just $1 million from the city, trying desperately with outdated books and to get the young people to get a GED, to try to connect them with jobs. When I spoke to the manager there, she told me that one thing they really wanted to do was to be able to afford to have a washing machine so that their students can come in and wash their clothes, so they have clean clothes for a job interview. Hmm. That is how challenged some of their students are.
So, few opportunities here, and it sounds like the time windows are smaller, too, that when programs come up, they don't tend to last very long.
Yes, that's one of the problems with federal job training program funding. A lot of it is geared toward older adults, perhaps, who've had some time in the workforce and don't need that much time to try to transition from one to another. But when you're talking about young people who may not have finished a high school diploma, young people who are still kind of immature, you know, back to the brain science again, they need more than 18 months to try to figure themselves out. But the funding is dependent upon how quickly can you get somebody ready to work. And with young people, you need more support. You need more time. A lot of these young people have gone through trauma, especially if they have come out of the foster care system, mm-hmm. which is another horrifically terrible system for young folks, or if they've had a brush with the law.
All right, we'll talk about aging out of the foster care system and emerging from the juvenile justice system for young people who don't have a real safety net to hold them up when they can fall down. And stuff piles up. You can't get a diploma while you're working in some cases. Caring for your child can cost you your job. There's all sorts of things that pile up for people in this situation. Ann Kim's book is called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. We'll come back and talk more about the situation here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation by phone and email when we return in a minute 20. You were talking about the fact that things are likely to get a bit worse with the effect of COVID-19 and the fact that that's going to potentially provide a huge economic crunch with all the activity that is not happening right now. There is a chapter in the book called When Work Disappears. Now, before coronavirus, I mean, employment was so high, but was it still not high in deserts, these economic deserts?
Right, it's not high deserts. It's not, and it's unemployment was already higher across the board for young people. When you're looking at 18 to 19 year olds, and this is again before the coronavirus, and I'll talk about the coronavirus in just a second. Even in the best of times, the unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate, keep in mind, measures the unemployment among people who are looking for jobs. That's not the same thing as people who are in the workforce. So low unemployment rates can be somewhat misleading because you're only looking at folks who are looking. But in the best of times, the unemployment rate among 18 to 19-year-olds was about 12%, so four times as high as the overall unemployment rate. And the unemployment was double for people who are 20 to 24. So it's already the case that young people were having difficulty finding work if they wanted it. In terms of what's happening now, young people really are going to bear the brunt of what's happening. Well, I was looking at some Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers right before this show. 30% of waiters and waitresses, servers, are between the ages of 20 and 24. And 1 in 5 retail salespeople are between the ages of 20 and 24. So we are talking about, with all of the closures across the country of restaurants, retail establishments, all of that is falling on the youngest people who need that first job, not just for the money, but for the experience later on. It's going to be catastrophic for this entire generation, I believe.
You write of a young woman, Keisha, in the Bronx, who worked a string of retail jobs. Did she find any real opportunities for advancement in there?
She didn't, and she didn't have her high school diploma. She had a large family, and part of her situation when I spoke to her at the time was that she had just become pregnant 3 months and wasn't sure what she was going to do in terms of childcare or even a place to live. Her situation in terms of housing was unstable at the time. But she had gone from a salad-making place to the Burlington Coat Factory, really wasn't finding any opportunities, no mentors to kind of get her up the retail ladder. And that lack of education, was really hampering her. And she had, a brush with the law as well, and that was turning out to be a black mark as far as her ability to get ahead.
You run through the things that are often missing for young people, career information, relevant job skills, diplomas. I mean, do you think the focus on driving up graduation rates works against students getting good job information and training?
Well, it cuts in a couple ways. On the one hand, if you have schools that are very focused on driving up graduation rates, that does create an incentive for some schools to push out the kids who may not have the easiest time. Those are the kids who are immediately disconnected. And there is quite a bit of research out there about, young boys of color in particular who are suspended, expelled at much higher rates. And there's a pipeline to disconnection right there. Oregon, tragically enough, has a high school graduation rate that is still much lower than that of the rest of the country. 76% of young people in Oregon graduate from high school compared to 85% nationally. Now, graduating from high school doesn't necessarily mean that you have all the skills that you have to have a job, but even on that basic level of are they graduating or are they not, you still have 1 out of 4 young folks in Oregon who aren't even getting that basic credential.
Oregon recently trumpeted that it did actually hit 80% in the most recent round for the class of 2019. Now, one of the interesting things, too, is that the CTE efforts, the career and technical education efforts, seem to have had a role in that. So by offering people more job skills, you also get more graduates.
That is really good news to hear about that. I'm sorry my numbers are out of date. CTE is absolutely critical to this because I think it provides a sense of relevance for young people as an alternative to the four-year track if that doesn't sound like something that's right for them. And truth of the matter is, you know, there are a lot of jobs in the so-called middle skills, you know, where you have to have some sort of higher education but not a four-year degree, that where there are shortages. Advanced manufacturing, for instance, doesn't require a four-year degree, but the manufacturing industry will tell you, once things get back to normal, that there are close to 2.5 million jobs that are going to be wanting over the next decade because it requires a different set of skills than manufacturing jobs did a generation ago. CTE is the answer to filling those gaps.
Now, to the issue that we've broached already, the issue of aging out for people in foster care reaching adulthood, the word in the system is emancipated, but you think there's a better term?
Abandoned.
Well,
emancipation, right. It's a cruel word to use to describe what happens to a child who is pretty much literally dumped out of the foster care system at age 18 or in some states at age 24. And this is a system that is supposed to have child welfare at its heart. But here's what happens to the 20,000 or so young people who age out of foster care every year. Only about a half of them will ever get a GED or high school diploma. A third of them are going to end up homeless. A third of them have been incarcerated. Fewer than 10% are going to have a two-year or four-year degree by the time that they're age 26. These are catastrophic failings by a system that is supposed to not only keep young people safe, but to give them opportunities in life that they could not get from their parents. But clearly the system is failing that job terribly.
Now, there are independent living programs. We've talked to them here on The Exchange, but you put independent living in quotes, Anne. Why?
Well, you know, these independent living programs still don't, don't get me wrong, there are many programs that do a great job of transitioning young people out into the real world. But many of these programs might be not long enough. They may not provide sufficient skills, or they, in some cases, ironically, they do too much in a sense that they're providing shelter, they're providing, you know, some services, but not teaching self-sufficiency, which is a different set of skills and requires a much greater commitment on the part of governments and on the part of community leaders to make sure that a young person is appropriately set up to take care of themselves versus being taken care of up until that point when they have to be on their own.
Now, do some programs actually extend to 21, but nothing goes beyond 21, right?
No. Perhaps in a few places there might be some experiments to do that beyond. There are a few states that might have college tuition waivers, very few. And so that kind of support may extend beyond 21. But in terms of real concerted support to ensure that someone is going to make it past that age, no, that's severely lacking.
Let's take a phone call here. John in Mount Shasta, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ann Kim, the author of Abandoned.
Yes, the CCC is the conservation corps that was established with FDR needs to be reestablished. It not only established a way to solve the Dust Bowl, but it also established a whole infrastructure of paid professionals all the way through healthcare and to take care of the environment. And what I have found in northern United States is that our fishing industry, our timber industry has been outsourced, exported out of the country. The owners of corporations found cheap labor and they have exported our resources out of the country. and thereby established a welfare and service industry that are nowhere jobs.
Okay, thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. So, yeah, there are some, certainly from private lands, raw logs getting sent overseas for processing that used to be processed in American mills. That is part of the picture. But how big an issue do you think outsourcing is? And what do you think about the idea, Anne, of reviving the Civilian Conservation Corps, as John proposes?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, what's happening, the current crisis, is going to make ideas like John's much more viable. You know, our economy is being remade as we speak in ways that we have not yet to contemplate. You know, there's talk now of sending checks to American families immediately, which I think is going to be a big help in the short term and needs to be done. In the long term, though, we're going to need a lot of jobs to replace the jobs that have been destroyed overnight by the coronavirus. And what John's talking about, like efforts like the Conservation Corps, public jobs may be the answer in the medium term, until we get the economy back on the ground. So I can see some opportunities coming to create these kinds of jobs in different parts of the country where the jobs have disappeared.
Let's talk about some of the efforts you saw that appear to be having some effect, and a positive effect here, because, you know, we're talking about most recently about the people who emerge from the foster care system, the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system, and don't really have any supports to keep them going. But Keisha, the woman in the Bronx who worked all the retail jobs, did get into a program, and it appears to have helped her.
It did. This program is called CASES. It's a nonprofit out of New York City, and it's one of the largest diversion programs in the city. What they do is work with the court system so that young people are not ending up incarcerated or in detention, but are instead being, quote-unquote, sentenced to go to this program where they can have opportunities to finish their high school education, get some job training, get mental health treatment they might need, substance abuse treatment if they need it. But most importantly, there is a, you know, very tight cadre of caring adults who are willing to take these young people under their wing. And one of the young men I talked to, he had actually graduated from this program, but he kept coming back because they were his substitute family. You know, there are a lot of nonprofits across the country who are really dedicating their staff to acting as surrogate families for young people who don't have resources otherwise. The problem is that we don't have enough nonprofits like that because mm-hmm. they're not getting funded.
So not funded by whom? By foundations, by government, both?
Foundations are doing most of the work. The Annie Casey Foundation, for instance, has done a lot. Hewlett, I can name others. The federal government spends about $2.5 billion a year only on programs that are targeted to young adults.
$2.5 billion, that's it for the whole country?
That is it. That is it. By comparison, we spend more than $560 billion a year on defense. And we're in a $3.7 trillion federal budget. So, you know, the amount of money that we spend is a pittance on these young adults who are so important.
And it seems like the money could be spent on what you call the high-touch initiatives, the programs that keep contact with the people, and that would extend more in time as well.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the investments, we can spend, you know, $10,000 in a young person today, and we will end up saving hundreds of thousands of dollars in the future. You know, conservative, liberal, no matter what you are, there's a common sense argument for investing in these programs today so that we have young adults who are productive, innovative, able to contribute to the economy in the future. That, I think, is the clearest budgetary argument you can make for upping what we spend on programs that work.
Now, Anne, we're down to our last minute. I can't imagine there's a one-size-fits-all approach because communities are very different each from the other. But are there some common traits you've observed for successful programs that do help give opportunity where none really existed before?
I would say that the most effective thing that communities can do is to create a pipeline between schools, community leaders, and most importantly, business. Business can really need to step up here and think about young people as an asset they can tap. Invest in someone, train in someone, give them an early work experience, an internship. You're going to end up with somebody 10 years down the road who may be your most dedicated employee. But you've got to look at that young person as maybe someone you haven't looked at before as an opportunity, someone you want to invest in today.
So make some connections with young people and help them make some connections in their brains so they can make use of the system as they age. The book is called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. It's the work of Ann Kim, who has joined us on The Exchange today. Ann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. That will do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. I hope things are going well in your world. Keep washing your hands. Join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.